This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Billy Collins has a poem about memory, or more precisely, losing your memory, called Forgetfulness. It perfectly describes the frustrations of not being able to recall a book or a name. Billy Collins has plenty of poems that perfectly describe ordinary feelings. On this archive edition, in celebration of National Poetry Month, we have an interview in which he read some of his poems. Collins has won several poetry awards. He's published in the 1992, 93, 97, 98, and 99 editions of the anthology Best American Poetry. He's a professor of English at Lehman College, City University of New York. I spoke with him in 1998, after the publication of his collection titled Picnic Lightning. Last year, a new edition of his 1991 collection, Questions About Angels, was published. It includes his poem, Forgetfulness. Well, Billy, I want you to read your poem, Forgetfulness. I think you've described this as your Over the Rainbow poem, like one of your... Is this like your greatest hit?
It is my one hit, and I feel embarrassed about reading it so many times, but then again, I think that the Coasters never stopped singing Charlie Brown. They never got tired of that, so it is. I think it has a kind of instant appeal because it's about something that's both... humorous, because we make fun of forgetfulness of, you know, people, absent-minded professors and people walking around with their glasses on their head looking for them. But at the same time, the loss of memory is frightening, and I try to handle both aspects of that.
Would you read it for us?
Sure. Forgetfulness. The name of the author is the first to go, followed obediently by the title, the plot, the heartbreaking conclusion. The entire novel, which suddenly becomes one you have never read, never even heard of. It is as if, one by one, the memories you used to harbor decided to retire to the southern hemisphere of the brain, to a little fishing village where there are no phones. Long ago, you kissed the names of the nine muses goodbye, and you watched the quadratic equation pack its bag. And even now, as you memorize the order of the planets, something else is slipping away. A state flower, perhaps, the address of an uncle, the capital of Paraguay. Whatever it is you are struggling to remember, it is not poised on the tip of your tongue, not even lurking in some obscure corner of your spleen. It has floated away down a dark mythological river whose name begins with an L, as far as you can recall, well on your own way to oblivion, where you will join those who have even forgotten how to swim and how to ride a bicycle. No wonder you rise in the middle of the night to look up the date of a famous battle in a book on war. No wonder the moon in the window seems to have drifted out of a love poem that you used to know by heart.
Oh, this is the story of my life.
Anyone over 10 can relate to that.
Oh, that's right. You know, I think it's probably particularly frightening to feel like you're losing your memory when you're a writer, because so much of your material comes from your life, which you've lived and are beginning to forget.
Indeed. And I think it starts with books, though, I think. John Updike said that he was, I think, about halfway through this Melville novel, Redburn, I think it was, before he realized that he'd read it before. And he came to that realization because he found his own notations in the margin. So losing the library that you've spent so many years collecting in your mind is also a kind of frightening loss.
Now, the poem about forgetfulness that you just read us, do you know it by heart?
I do know that one by heart, yes.
That's good. and how did you get to memorize it? Did you have to? Is it just from having read it a lot?
It's just from having read it a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think it has now that poetry has kind of dropped end rhyme at least and regular meter, it's much more difficult to memorize. But if I think one thing that helps you memorize a poem is the rhythmic quality of it. If it has a certain sure-footed rhythm, it's much easier to get it into your head.
One of the things I really like about your poetry is, well, how plain spoken it is in a way. I mean, it's about very ordinary experience, and it uses an ideal version of ordinary language.
I think poetic language is in fact that. It's language that is kind of tidied. It's language that's steam cleaned or purified. Language that comes under principles of organization and even neatness that are missing in certainly conversation and even in well-written prose, perhaps.
Did your poems always stick to ordinary life and always have the directness that they have, or did you ever write in other styles?
No, I wrote in awful styles when I started, mostly slavishly imitative styles.
Of who?
William Carlos Williams, Wallace Stevens, Ferlinghetti, producing really awful versions of almost unintentional parodies of these people. And it was really before I found my voice. I mean, that expression is one I'm not happy with. It sounds like it's like your voice is slipped behind the couch or something. But I think when I started to write poems that I felt only I could have written, and I think that's the point you either get to or you don't in writing poems, I felt that I had released a lot of myself into the poems, and they did become, as you said, more relaxed. They started out, at least, on very conversational notes. I think it's a sign of my overall obsession with attracting and keeping readers. I mean, all the poems have different subjects, but I think the ultimate subject of all these poems is the engagement that takes place between the poem and the reader. I don't think readers enjoy being led down a flight of stairs into an unlit basement, and that's the feeling I get from reading quite a few contemporary poems.
Well, I know exactly what you mean, and there's a lot of poems where I'll really love the beginning, and then I just totally get lost deeper in, and the imagery becomes so obscure. I might like the way the language sounds, but I have no idea sometimes what the poet is communicating.
Yes, I think there are several reasons for obscurity in poetry, and one of them is just maybe hide the banality of what's really being said. I'm not really greatly concerned with the large issue of what the audience is for American poetry, but I'm very deeply concerned about the audience for my poetry, and I try to address that concern in every poem I write, usually by starting out on some familiar note, so that the poem at least begins with something we share in common. Then I feel the poem can take the reader on an unfamiliar ride, perhaps, and take him to a place of surprise toward the end. But I really think that I'm supplying half of a possible engagement, and that the second half of that takes place in the reader's mind.
I know what you mean, and I think as a reader, one of the things I gravitate to about your poems is a sense of recognition, you know, of like, oh yeah, I know that feeling, I've had that feeling, I've experienced the forgetfulness that you're describing, I've experienced not being able to take that vacation.
I think the case might be that most of the poems that I'm writing and the ones I've been reading are not so much memory-driven, but they're more conceptually driven. Not by a big concept, but maybe just by a little notion.
Mm-hmm.
But I tend not to write about my past in the way that, a kind of autobiographical way that poems would include as their kind of nervous subjects, the family or their childhoods. I guess I don't want to presume that anyone's interested in my past. I think they might be more interested in a notion that overlaps all of our experience.
There's a poem I want you to read called Asobuco, and this is really a poem about contentment. Is contentment a difficult thing to write about?
It is nearly impossible to write about, I think. I think it's very challenging to write about, because serious art, at least since the Romantics, since about, you know, the beginning of the 19th century, serious art takes sadness as a given. And I think people are very suspicious of literary works that include or center on pleasure, happiness, contentment. But of course, these things are part of our lives.
But the kind of contentment that this poem is describing, it isn't even like ecstasy or the big happiness. It's merely contentment.
It's a small bit of contentment, and I think the poem gets a little more complicated than that later on.
Why don't you read it for us?
I'd be glad to. It's called Osobuco. I love the sound of the bone against the plate and the fortress-like look of it lying before me in a moat of risotto, the meat soft as the leg of an angel who has lived a purely airborne existence, and best of all, the secret marrow, the invaded privacy of the animal, prized out with a knife and swallowed down with cold, exhilarating wine. I am swaying now in the hour after dinner, a citizen tilted back on his chair, a creature with a full stomach, something you don't hear much about in poetry, that sanctuary of hunger and deprivation. You know, the driving rain, the boots by the door, small birds searching for berries in winter. But tonight, the lion of contentment has placed a warm, heavy paw on my chest, and I can only close my eyes and listen to the drums of woe throbbing in the distance and the sound of my wife's laughter on the telephone in the next room, the woman who cooked the savory osso buco, who pointed to show the butcher the one she wanted, she who talks to her faraway friend while I linger here at the table with a hot companionable cup of tea, feeling like one of the friendly natives, a reliable guide, maybe even the chief's favorite son. Somewhere a man is crawling up a rocky hillside on bleeding knees and palms, an Irish penitent carrying the stone of the world in his stomach, and elsewhere people of all nations stare at one another across a long empty table. But here the candles give off their warm glow, the same light that Shakespeare and Isaac Walton wrote by, the light that lit and shadowed the faces of history. Only now it plays on the blue plates, the crumpled napkins, the crossed knife and fork. In a while, one of us will go up to bed, and the other one will follow. Then we will slip below the surface of the night into miles of water, drifting down and down to the dark, soundless bottom, until the weight of dreams pulls us lower still, below the shale and layered rock, beneath the strata of hunger and pleasure, into the broken bones of the earth itself, into the marrow of the only place we know.
How did you decide to write that poem?
I think I started, I don't know where the poems are going. Most poets say that, but it does tend to be true. I think I did start with simply an attempt to write a little poem in praise of a pleasure of eating this terrific meal. I didn't know where it was going, and if there is no, I think of the poems as little journeys or little rides, if you will, as kind of cheap forms of transportation. And I like to end up in a very different place at the end of the poem than I started at the beginning. And I mean, here I start at the kitchen table and I end up kind of in the middle of the earth. So it's that kind of travel that interests me. I think it's a little like writing the poem and not knowing exactly where you're going. It's a little like driving a car at night where the headlights allow you to see ahead of yourself just so far in order to keep the thing going, but you can't see any farther than that.
My guest is poet Billy Collins. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is poet Billy Collins. You're very good in your poems at describing how effortless writing sometimes can be and how difficult it could be at other times. In a poem called Tuesday, June 4th, 1991, you write, "I feel like the secretary to the morning, whose only responsibility is to take down its bright, airy dictation. Until it's time to go to lunch with the other girls, all of us ordering the cottage cheese with half a pear." But then you have another poem about how hard it is to write, and I was trying to find that poem this morning, and I couldn't find it, so maybe you know the poem I'm talking about.
I'm not sure of the poem, but I think there are two. I mean, sometimes it's easy and sometimes it's hard. There's kind of a downhill poem, and there's kind of a that does tend to write itself slightly, and then there's a very uphill poem that requires a tremendous amount of sweat. You know, it's very different for different poets. I think it's some poets, they're talking, it's 90% revision. It's a little like, I've compared it to what I consider the two styles of cooking. One style of cook cleans, you clean as you go along, right? You kind of dice up a carrot, and then you have to clean off the board, and the other type just makes a huge mess and cleans it up later. And I think some writers want to get it right the first time. They can't proceed with the next sentence until the first one is correct. And my style is more to make a mess, just to crash through and to keep something of the spontaneity of the moment. Because the person who comes back to revise the poem is really a different person. It's like Heraclitus talking about not being able to stick your foot in the same stream twice. The person who comes back the next morning to revise or the next month to revise is a slightly different creature. And I'd rather not have the poem be a kind of collaboration between all these sides of myself. I'd rather have the heart of it, at least the thrust of it, come out of one moment, of one sitting, one mood.
A lot of your poems have to do with sleep and dreams. Several of your poems end there. Some of your poems are just totally about that. And I'm wondering if sleep is often restful for you.
I'm just lazy, is what you're implying. Well, Keats is the great poet of sleep and dreams and drowsiness, which was thought to be a kind of a receptive state of mind. It might be that I just have too much time on my hands. Max Beerbohm once said that the hardest thing about being a poet was knowing what to do with the other 23 and a half hours in the day.
Right. How long are you going to really sit there and write?
That's right.
Yeah. So do you take a lot of naps?
I do when I can, yes. And I think waking up from a nap or from sleep is a very good state in which to think about things to write about and even to begin writing. Before the language of the world has a chance to infiltrate your ears, before you hear the radio or someone else talking or read a newspaper, I think that's a good time to write, because I think language can be fresher in those occasions when you're closer to sleep.
You have a poem called The Night House, which is in part about sleep and the difference between the waking mind and the unconscious mm-hmm. mind, the sleeping mind.
It's a poem. It's kind of a meditation on, another great time to write, of course, is as a response to insomnia. And I suppose the poem is kind of a meditation on insomnia, and also a sense that things happen when we're asleep. You know how in those old cartoons, like the teapot and all the things in the kitchen come alive, and but this is a sense that the body itself begins to kind of go off in its own directions. Shall I read it?
Please.
The Night House. Every day, the body works in the fields of the world, mending a stone wall or swinging a sickle through the tall grass, the grass of civics, the grass of money. And every night the body curls around itself and listens for the soft bells of sleep. But the heart is restless and rises from the body in the middle of the night, leaves the trapezoidal bedroom with its thick, pictureless walls to sit by herself at the kitchen table and heat some milk in a pan. And the mind gets up too, puts on a robe and goes downstairs, lights a cigarette and opens a book on engineering. Even the conscience awakens and roams from room to room in the dark, darting away from every mirror like a strange fish. And the soul is up on the roof in her nightdress, straddling the ridge, singing a song about the wildness of the sea, until the first rip of pink appears in the sky. Then they will all return to the sleeping body, the way a flock of birds settles back into a tree, resuming their daily colloquy, talking to each other or themselves, even through the heat of the long afternoons. Which is why the body, that house of voices, sometimes puts down its metal tongs, its needle, or its pen, to stare into the distance, to listen to all its names being called before bending again to its labor.
That's a beautiful poem.
Thank you, Terry.
You know, on those nights when you can't sleep, when you do have insomnia, do you panic about life in general?
That nervousness, the anxiety that or the coffee or whatever that doesn't let you sleep, is something that makes the pen jitter. I mean, this is the stuff that I think poets, wag their tails over. It is a nervous response, It is a nervous sign that something is, there's some turbulence or some disturbance in your inner life. And for me, one of the functions or one of the beauties of poetry is that it's something to do with your inner life. It's an activity. The writing and the construction of poems is an external activity that brings the inner life out of yourself and gives you a way to deal with it and understand it.
Billy Collins, I love your poems. I want to thank you so much for reading some of them for us. I wish we had time for some more.
The pleasure's been all mine, Terry.
Poet Billy Collins, recorded in 1998. His books include Picnic Lightning and Questions About Angels. This is Fresh Air.